This is Julio Rodriguez, and this is the Lookout Landing podcast.
This is the Lookout Landing podcast. My name is Matthew Robertson, staff writer, podcast host, friend of yours on the internet and in your earbuds. And today we are doing another episode of the Why I'm a Mariners Fan series. I do not know how many more of these we will be doing as the season gets closer, and we'll also talk about actual baseball. But we have made some time for a very special guest today. I am joined by a local musician who has an album coming out on April 7th and is playing a show on April 30th at the Sunset Tavern in Ballard. But most importantly, is a true to the blue fan of the Seattle Mariners, the one and only Tomo Nakayama. What's going on, Tomo?
How you doing?
I'm doing all right. I feel like I've almost made it to the point in life where things start to make sense again, you know, in terms right. of the calendar and baseball being here and the weather not being just a total shit show every day. So sure. I can feel it, you know, we're almost there.
Yeah, and we got Taiwan back today, right?
That is the big news of the day. Yeah, yeah. We are recording this on the 12th, and pitchers and catchers have reported, and Taiwan Walker is one of those pitchers. So yeah, I think it's as official as it'll get. I think it's a one-year deal with some incentives, but Taiwan Walker is here. How are you feeling about that? Are you a big Taiwan Walker guy?
I feel great, man. That's like a win-win situation, I think. I mean, he looked really great for us for years, right? And then I guess it's a one-year deal, you said?
Yeah, I believe it's like 1 year, $2 million. Yeah. And if he pitches well enough, there's some incentives that he can qualify for.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, pretty low risk, and he's such a good dude, you know? Seems like.
Yeah. I think that's where I am, too. Like, I am totally aware of the fact that he's not going to be, like, a great pitcher. He could be fine, but, like, he had some injury stuff, and then, you know, he's been pretty much out for all of last year. But the good guy part is really the reason why I'm so excited, because for this upcoming season, I just want guys that I enjoy watching and can root for. I don't really, yeah. I know we're not going to win very much, so might as well give us some entertainment value, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
How are you feeling, I guess, before we get into the actual reasons for your fandom, how are you feeling right now on the first day of spring training? What does that day every year sort of drum up inside of you?
You know, I honestly kind of took 2019 off, like, mentally from, like, caring, you know, just obsessively watching the Mariners, because it seemed like a good season to kind of like take a little space. So I feel ready again to have my heart broken all over again. So.
No, I totally get that. I've talked to a lot of people who have mentioned that, you know, after 2018, where it looked like they were going to make the playoffs and then the bottom falls out and then they basically gut the roster, that was when a lot of people, I think, like yourself, it sounds like, took stock of their situation and were like, maybe this is my year to not care as much or to find another hobby from March through October.
Well, they kind of peaked early with Ichiro retiring, you know, and then it was just it was hard to just get too attached to anyone on the roster. So, I mean, I kept an eye on the games and everything, but it was hard to feel like a personal attachment to, you know, like Edwin Encarnacion, you know, like right. I really liked that dude, but then he was gone like midseason, and so it was hard to like really care.
No, you're preaching to the choir. I mean, yeah. I'm someone who, like, because of what I do for Lookout Landing, I do have to pay attention. But I was, like, even at the point in June and July where I was like, I don't, A, really know anything about these guys. And then, B, like, that makes it pretty hard to get, like, invested. Like, I was watching, but I didn't have the, like, the same sort of attachment that I would. Like, when my favorite players will mess up, I'm like, oh, I feel bad for them. But when the 2019 Mariners messed up, I was like, oh, you know, whatever. Par for the course.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess it was like a pretty like lighthearted season to watch, you know what I mean? Because expectations were low, so.
Yeah, low expectations are usually a good setting for like avoiding disappointment. You know, if you go in expecting 65 wins, then if they hit even 66, we'll be thrilled, you know?
Right, yeah.
So are you a Seattle lifer, or is your fandom as simple as growing up here and being plopped down in front of the TV listening to Dave Niehaus, or is it more complicated than that? Take me back to when you first became aware of the Seattle Mariners.
So I was born in Japan, and then I moved here in 1988. I was 8 years old, and I don't think my family was really into baseball too much, but then I started playing Little League in second grade. I grew up on the east side in Bellevue, and then I think my parents took me to the Kingdom. My first memory of it is like 1990, I think, was when I got really into, I started understanding the rules of the game, you know, and then I just always grew up with it. And then because I was playing Little League, my parents got into baseball as well. And we just, it just kind of became a family thing that we did together, you know. But I went to all the camps, summer camps and stuff. Like Seafirst Bank used to do a baseball camp. And one year I got to go when Edgar Martinez was one of the instructors. And so I played catch with Edgar.
Wow.
Yeah. And that was 91, I think. It was the year he shaved his mustache. and he really became Edgar Martinez, you know, like it was when he switched from third base to DH, and I don't know. I just have a lot of childhood memories of watching them, yeah.
Yeah, so it sounds, I mean, people always talk about when Edgar switched from third base to DH, that was a big turning point. But I think you've uncovered some other things with the mustache and then also playing catch with a young Tomo. That might have actually got his career on the right track. Did you give him any tips or anything, or just a standard throw the ball back and forth situation?
So I was kind of a numbers nerd even when I was a kid. And I remember like when he asked if we had any questions, and I kind of put him on the spot because I said, so last year you had 40 errors at third base, and this year you it went down to, I can't remember, I think it was like 11 or something, really low. And I was like, how did you how did you improve your defense? And I think he just said hard work and practice or something like that. But he actually was a pretty great third baseman for a couple of years before he got hurt, you know, and then switched to DH. But yeah,
I don't have any story that's that romantic, I guess, with interacting with the Mariners, or any sort of, like, obviously Edgar Martinez is like the guy for the entire franchise. But
oh, totally.
I remember one time when I was in probably second or third grade. I was actually at a batting cage in Bellevue with my baseball team. And Bigatoshi Hasegawa was there with his kid.
Was it at Dave Henderson's batting cage?
I do not know. I was a child.
Oh, I bet you it was, because he used to run one in Bellevue.
Maybe. I'm blanking on the name of the place now, too. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure it's certainly possible that it was that. But anyway, like, we were there as a team with our, like, organized practice, you know, and then Shiggy was there with his kid in, like, a private sort of cage setting. But obviously, like, once one person noticed that he was there, everyone started watching. And everyone was watching when he accidentally hit his kid. Like, he was pitching to him, and he drilled him with a pitch. And we were all like, oh, that wasn't supposed to happen. Like, it's almost like, you know, when you see, like, something, like, when you're a kid and you see, like, a teacher outside of school, or you hear your parents swear, and you're like, whoa, this has never happened before. Like, everything is now different. That's exactly what it felt like.
That's awesome.
Yeah, there's no, I don't have any, like, deeper meaning to that story. I just, your thing with Edgar reminded me of it.
Sure, yeah.
So You mentioned Edgar, obviously, and, you know, growing up, coming of age, I guess, in the early 90s. Who were some of your guys on the team? Did you have favorite players that you think helped you sort of understand baseball more? Or my personal favorite, a guy who, when you got older, you realized wasn't actually very good,
but at the time,
he was your favorite?
My favorite player, and I actually dressed as him for Halloween when I was in third grade, was Pete O'Brien, the first baseman.
Okay, yeah.
Who was not good at all, I realized later. But I just really liked, he always looked like he was like laughing when he was hitting. Mm-hmm. And he just made the game look fun. And so I really, I don't know why, I was really a big Pete O'Brien fan. And I also liked Mike Jackson, the reliever.
Mm-hmm.
His slider was pretty amazing. He had a couple different stints with the Mariners, I think. But, yeah, I don't know. I have a lot of love for, like, so I think, what was it? 90, I think, was the first year we had a winning season. It was the Lefevre-Believer year.
Uh-huh.
And I remember it being, like, a huge deal, you know? Like, even, it was before we had the whole 95 thing, you know? So that was kind of our high point, was like, oh, we got 500 for the first time.
Yeah, well, when you go through, I mean, the entire 80s, they didn't do anything.
So, yeah,
like, it makes
yeah.
sense. It's funny in retrospect, like a team celebrating just getting to 500. But at the time, like, you really couldn't blame them. And you know that the franchise as a business was excited about it. Like, that
sure.
was the best thing they'd ever accomplished.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And maybe that's, I mean, that might be why I got really hooked on it, you know, it was like, it felt like a big moment, you know, like that things were looking up and that sports could do that, you know, like that you could accomplish something that no one in the history of the franchise had done before.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
So, and then speaking of which, are you then still here, still in the area in 95?
Yeah.
Are you, how involved are you in that season? Like, do you have memories of being at the Kingdome for any of those games?
95? Oh, yeah. No, I wasn't at the games, but I remember watching them with my friends at my friend's house. And yeah, that was a crazy season. It kept ramping up, you know, and there's like, how old was I? I was in middle school or something. So I understood like how improbable it was, you know, but, mm-hmm. it just felt, inevitable at the same time, that they were just such on a roll, you know. It reminds me a lot of like the Seahawks when they went to the Super Bowl.
Right.
It you know, just even when they were behind, it was you felt like they were gonna have something up their sleeve and yeah, I remember just like watching that hit, you know, Edgar's hit, and yeah, just freaking out. But I mean, my family, we watched all the games, but you know, we couldn't really afford to go to the playoff games, or we weren't hardcore enough to get get season tickets and stuff like that. So a lot of it was TV, and you know, that was the golden age of Dave Niehaus and, you know, and television, really. It was free, and it was on a channel 11, so I'd just be watching it every day after school. Yeah.
Do you ever think about how, like, if things had broken differently for the Mariners, if you would have gotten that invested? Like, obviously, if, you know, if the winning season never comes, or if 95 never comes, or even if there's no Dave Niehaus, do you think that you would have maybe kept them at arm's length a little more, and that, like, those factors all kind of combined to make something magical, for lack of a better word?
I mean, yeah, definitely. I don't. I think Dave was more of a factor than the players, in some sense, you know what I mean? Like, just the way he told the stories and explained the game, and I really like learned baseball through him, you know what I mean? And but just those 90s teams were pretty incredible. Just the, like, well, having Griffey, and then there were such big personalities, you know, and there was a story behind each guy, and I just, I don't know, yeah, I don't think the winning made so much of a difference to me as much as just, like, the storytelling and the people, you know, that were involved. Those players become announcers, you know, like Harold Reynolds and Dave Valley and Bill Krueger and stuff, and just, like, seeing the same faces over again, it just feels really like a family, you know, and then getting to, like, watch those dudes get older I like seeing that kind of, like, passed on through generations and stuff, so I've always appreciated that about baseball.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's, especially with the Mariners, there's, like, the familial element is so there because, A, they're not a very old franchise. I mean, they've only been around since the late 70s. But also, like, with the sort of, you know, for lack of a better term, like, the sustained badness, like, it kind of creates the, like, you know, if you know, you know, sort of phenomena where, like, these people that you mentioned, like, you know, Harold Reynolds, Dave Valley, Bill Krueger, like, Dan Wilson now is doing some broadcasting stuff. Like, they could all easily just live their lives, but, like, they know that the Mariners are so important to people's lives and probably to their lives that I think that's probably a big thing that keeps them around the game is, like, the Mariners are not just their job. It's, like, a thing that they did that has shaped them, and they want to also continue to be a part of it. And also, like, I read literally today, again, it's February 12th, Franklin Gutierrez is, like, at spring training working with the outfielders, and, like, he doesn't have to do that, you know? No. But there's something in him that's like, oh, yeah, the Mariners are meaningful to me. They, I'm guessing, treated him well enough for him to be like, yeah, I'll give back, you know, I'll go hang out in spring training and work with the outfielders. Like, I know that it's not, you know, other franchises could bring back, you know, like the Yankees and Dodgers and Red Sox can bring back Hall of Famers to talk to their players, and the Mariners just have, you know, Franklin Gutierrez and Dan Wilson or whatever. But that still feels like those guys do kind of feel like superheroes in a way because they were here, like they were in the trenches with us, sort of thing. You know what I'm talking about?
Totally, man. And especially guys like Franklin, who, like, had so much potential and so much hardship in their careers, who, like, never fully reached their potential, but like, you were with them, you know, through their journey. Like, he's, like, the quintessential Mariner a lot of ways, you know, and like, the stats don't matter so much as, like, the just if you had seen him in his peak, like, you know how great of a player he was, you know, and, like, what and the fact that, like, the Mariners stuck with him and he stuck with the Mariners, like, that kind of stuff, like, means more than you know, like, I think that's why there was so much hate towards A-Rod when he left, you know, because there weren't that many players that just purely left for money, you know, and it hurt, you know, like, on a personal level, like, it really, like, felt like a huge betrayal, you know.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt, but it's interesting, like, I'm sure you've experienced this too, like, once you get older and you understand how these things work, I think our opinions on this change. Like, how did you feel about A-Rod and Griffey leaving at the time compared to when you think about it today? Like, I'm sure there was some animosity, or maybe you were heartbroken, like, those were, you know, the two best players in franchise history. But now, understanding, like, I guess the business side or the human side of it, like, what are your, are you, do you still feel as betrayed by them as you did when you were, when it was happening?
I mean, I never felt betrayed by Griffey so much, because it seemed like it was, there was, you know, there was some, you know, it seemed like there was stuff going on both sides, like, both the team and Griffey, that made it, you know, untenable. And then it made sense to me that he wanted to be closer to his family, and, like, I don't know. It, yeah, it and the fact that we got players back, you know, like my Cameron, like yeah. that immediately contributed. It stung a little bit less, but like, yeah, I don't know with A-Rod. I mean, because he was such like, you know, he came through our system. Like he was supposed to be the next Griffey, right? Like he was the dude that like came out of our draft, and like, you know, it still doesn't make sense to me really that I don't know. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, the easy way to distill it is like, oh, well, the Rangers just gave him, you know, more money than God. Like, who wouldn't take that? But then you also start to think, like, I mean, you mentioned it. Like, he came up in our system. We were the only franchise that he knew. The Mariners were good at the time. Like, the Rangers were awful. Like, he could have stayed here mm-hmm. for less money and had a chance to straight up win the World Series, become, like, the most beloved player in Seattle sports history. And he just decided to not do that. And that was the hard part for me when it was happening. I was like, why would he want to go? And Safeco Field was brand new at that time, too.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Everything on paper was there for A-Rod to play his whole career in Seattle, like to essentially be to the 2000s what Russell Wilson has been to the 2010s. And instead he was like, no, I'm going to move to Texas, a division rival, because they offered me $262 million or whatever it was. Like that, when I was analyzing it at the time as a kid, also I was pretty young, it was like, this guy's a jerk. Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
You can make money anywhere, you know? And then I got into like the throwing money thing at him. Again, I was a kid. I would not probably have responded the same way as an adult. But like when he came to town and everyone was billing and throwing money, I thought that was both funny and like a little bit deserved. And there's no way I would do any of that stuff now. But like, I don't know. It's weird to have your brain sort of warped in that way by sports, because that's also like
sure.
no other job do you even know that it's happening. People leave jobs all the time for more money, and like it's only sports and public facing things where we as the public feel like we have a right to get mad about it, you know?
Yeah. I have another summer camp related story.
Yeah.
A few years after that Edgar camp that I went to, my little brother won a contest from, I think it was Lowe's Hardware, to go to Safeco to meet Alex Rodriguez, right? So mm-hmm. I was his chaperone, and I took him, and just the difference between Edgar's approach with the kids and, like, A-Rod, you know, like, A-Rod comes out, and he's like, he's wearing like a suit or something, you know, he's not even like wearing his uniform, and he comes out and he's like, he's demonstrating how you have to have like a light pivot foot when you're swinging the bat, and he's like, you have to be able to twist your pivot foot light enough that you don't make a hole in a dollar bill. So he like he pulls out a big wad of cash, right? And he's like, God. Oh, I don't have any ones, but here's $100. And he puts it on the ground, he steps on it, and he demonstrates his swing, right? And I'm like, what an asshole. So from that moment, it was like, it was pretty clear that in where his priorities were. I mean, if he went to the Yankees or to you know, like the, who else, Dodgers or something, like it would have made a little more sense. Like, yeah, he wants money, but he also wants to win, you know. But like, just to go to go to the Rangers of all places, like, yeah. it just, yeah, I'll never understand it.
That is a great story, though. Did he make a hole in the dollar bill? Do you remember?
No, like, no. He's a great, great baseball player.
Yeah, that's
like,
true.
Yeah, he had a
that's
perfect
actually
swing.
Very easy to forget. Is like, you could really make an argument for like A-Rod and Barry Bonds being probably the two greatest baseball players of all time.
Absolutely.
But they're also both
yeah.
like universally known as assholes, which is a bummer.
Yeah.
Well, and then also, I guess, now that I'm thinking about it, you also have the complete opposite of that with Ichiro, like a bona fide superstar, undeniably one of the better baseball players ever.
Uh-huh.
And like the only stories we really heard about him were like how much he loved baseball and then how like sneaky funny he was. Like, I don't know if there's a single bad story out there about Ichiro at all. What's your attachment level to Ichiro as someone, because I'm like, for me, he was like the kid that I, or he was the player that I watched growing up. Like, he was basically mm-hmm. my Griffey, because I was a little too young for most of Griffey's career, and then I got to grow up with Ichiro. So he's like basically like a god to me. But I'm curious what he meant to you as a Mariner fan.
Well, so there were a few years after after 95, and we started going to the playoffs pretty regularly for a few years, where I kind of lost interest just a little bit, you know, well, I just got more, you know, into my life, you know, just like in high school and stuff.
Sure.
And
yeah, you're becoming a person.
yeah, becoming a person. But then, in 2001, when Ichiro came over, my dad actually he was working in Silicon Valley, and then he lost his job in the dot-com bust, like in the late 90s, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was unemployed for a while, and then Ichiro came over, and there was this whole industry of you know, Japanese related businesses that he brought with him, you know. So my dad got a job at Safeco, actually, as a with a Japanese broadcast company.
Wow.
That sent like, it was just like a digital, you know, they sent the actual TV signals over to Japan in real time, you know, because people were watching the games over there.
That's
at
hard,
7
yeah.
in the morning or whatever. So yeah, so it became like the baseball actually became like our family, you know, like livelihood. And and everything about Ichiro was just so like I don't know, he embodied the Mariners to me in a lot of ways, because it wasn't it was just about just like consistency, just about showing up every day and just like doing your best and and not really like always getting the results that you want, but just like just still keeping like you know, like that professionalism, that attitude, and I think that was really like misunderstood by a lot of fans, that, you know, maybe thought that he was like off-putting or wasn't as communicative or something. But like,
yeah,
I just really admired his, and also like I speak Japanese as well, so I would see some of the interviews that he would do for the Japanese media, and his personality was like just totally different, you know. And I don't think we got to see that fully in America until like that speech he gave at his retirement, you know, when he spoke in English.
Mm-hmm.
Like that was like, that's like his true self, you know, where he can just like really but you know, the amount of preparation he put into that, you know, just like speaking English, it wasn't something that he just wanted to do like off the cuff, you know, like he really wanted to perfect it.
Yeah.
And you could really feel that, you know. So yeah, I don't, I have a real personal connection to those Ichiro years.
think to kind of tie this all together, like, he was very prideful in a way that I think was in a direct direct opposition to the way that A-Rod was prideful. Like, you could tell that A-Rod really cared about himself, and that's not necessarily mm-hmm. always a bad thing, but like, he knew that he wanted to be the highest paid player, he wanted to win MVPs eventually, like when he went to the Yankees, he wanted to win championships. And I think at least the vibe that I got from Ichiro was like, he took all of baseball and everything that surrounded it so seriously because he knew that that's what the fans deserved. Like, he didn't want to shortchange anyone who cared about him. That was sort of what I remember about watching Ichiro. I was like, this guy is so, like you said, that sort of understated greatness showing up every day. But you never got the sense that it was about him. Like, his ego never really was something that anyone ever even considered. Like, it seemed like he was doing baseball as a profession, but also as like his, like, it was his duty almost, or like the thing he was put on earth to do was to make people happy through baseball. Whereas you had some, in every sport, you have some athletes who realize they're good at the sport and then want that to just be the way to elevate themselves, you know what I mean?
Sure. And I see a lot of similarities with like Russell Wilson, the way he runs the ball, for instance, you know, like he's exciting and can do all the things that, like, you know, like a player like Cam Newton could do. Mm-hmm. But like he takes really calculated risks, you know, to like not get injured. And Ichiro was always like that. Like he could crash into walls and go for like really crazy catches and stuff. But like he was always like calculating, like in the moment, like what is the bigger picture? Like how do I stay in the season as long as I can, right? And just and that amount of like just bigger picture shit that like. You could see him like working through in his head. That I thought was really like fascinating, you know. And I think it was the reason a lot of people were like really frustrated with him, you know, because he could hit home runs and he could, you know, like slide for, you know, more difficult catches and stuff. Yeah. But it was never about like highlight reels with him. Like he wanted to perform, you know, as high at a level as he could for as many games as he could. And that's how he would help the team out, you know?
Yeah. Weird. You know? I think that's the biggest bummer about Ichiro and Felix's career and the way that they unfolded. Like, they were really just a victim of bad timing more than anything else because, mm-hmm. I mean, Ichiro gets the one playoff year in his rookie year, and then Felix gets, like, teams that are contending for the playoffs as he himself is declining. And like both of them are doing the exact thing you talked about of like trying to put out like the best version of themselves and like really giving their all to this, but not getting, I guess, the full extent of the experience because their team is limiting them so much. So I guess my question to you then is, what did those lean years of, I guess we can call it like the mid to late 2000s and then the early 2010s, what did those do to you as a fan, knowing that opening day almost every year that the Mariners have no shot, and unless something crazy happens, they're not going to have much of a shot the year after that? Like, how does that over and over again sort of wear on you as a person?
I mean, if anything, those years like made my love for the team stronger, I feel like, you know.
No, absolutely. That's been a common thing. I mean, with any adversity, it's kind of a fight or flight thing. Like, you're either gonna get even more into it, or you're just gonna bail. And I think that both are totally understandable with the Mariners, but I'm always curious to hear what people say.
Well, here's a crazy thing. Like, so in 2006, I think, or five, we were having a really terrible season, but my dad was working at Safeco, and he had a brain aneurysm, and then he had to go to Japan to get it operated on. So while he was gone, I actually took over his job, because they just needed someone who understood his job and could speak Japanese. So I ended up working at Safeco for like half a season. So I got to sit, you know, where my dad would just sit and watch the games day after day, and they were not a good team, you know. It was just like watching them lose day after day, but still, like, you know, Ichiro was there just like doing his job. Felix was there just like it. There was something just like, I don't know. It gave me comfort, you know, like, it was a really scary time. Like, I wasn't sure what was going to happen with my dad and, you know, and then one day, you know, I was going up to the press room because, they give us free hot dogs in the press room. That was one of the perks of the job. So I was going up in the elevator, and then Dave Niehaus got on. Oof. Right. And it was just the two of us in the elevator. I remember he was wearing a pink shirt, you know, a pink polo shirt, and he just he looked like Dave, that dude, you know. And then I really wanted to talk to him, but I was supposed to be working, you know. I was trying to be professional, so I just said hi, and he's like, he said hey there, and I don't know, just all the feelings that I had, you know, just like listening to him, you know, as a kid, just like came up. And I had a pretty good cry that night, but that still like stays with me to this day. And I think he passed away a couple years after that, Dave did. And I to this day like wish I would have said something more to him, you know. But I don't know, it felt like baseball was there for me like when I needed it most, you know, like at that moment. So my love for the Mariners is pretty like just closely tied to my family, it's a personal thing.
I totally know what you're saying about like there is something so sort of startling about when you meet someone that's that famous or that important in your life, and like you said, they look like them, they sound like them, like they're everything mm-hmm. that you would totally expect. Like there's no. Because sometimes when you think when you're going to meet a famous person that there's going to be like they're going to feel so different, there's going to be like a big well of excitement, but then you, especially in a one-on-one situation, like you were in an elevator, like obviously he's just a guy, like he's not gonna have like a different voice or a different look, but seeing it actualized right in front of you can be so striking. I know exactly mm-hmm. what you're talking about with that. And then you do freeze up, like there's nothing you can really say that you would think in your mind would do any justice to the feeling that you have.
Yeah.
One of the most like, because I think like something very specific to sports is like these things that mean so much to you that other people like literally will have never heard of sometimes. Like people know the Mariners obviously, and like I think most people in the area like would be like, oh yeah, Ken Griffey, Ichiro, I know who that is. But Dave Niehaus is one of those perfect examples of like some people like worship him and he's like a huge figure in their life, like probably you and me. And then there's also mm-hmm. people who have no idea who he is. And I remember like some, like, you know, when you're just having like, you know, random conversations or you're doing like some icebreaker or there's like a weird situation where people are asking you questions. And like one that's I've gotten before is like, oh, what celebrity death impacted you the most? And I thought about it and I was like, well, it's probably Dave Niehaus. Like,
yeah,
and people are like, that doesn't mean anything to me, like explain. And then I'm like, oh, he was, you know, you say it out loud and it sounds kind of funny. You're like, oh, he's a baseball announcer. He did play-by-play for the Mariners. But like, you know, he wasn't like a rock star or anything like that. Like nothing that you would think would really like shake a person to their core the way that he did. But when he died, I remember thinking like, oh, this is a huge part of me and the reason why I am in some ways the way I am, like why I love baseball so much, why I like thinking and talking about baseball so much is because I watched and listened to Dave Niehaus do it for so long. And you know, definitely at certain points in my life where like I want to be him, and then when he was gone it was tough. So yeah, I'm glad that we have a space to talk about this that's not like, oh, you know, saying it at a bar or whatever and people look at you like you're, you know, your head is on fire or something like that.
Totally, man. And the fact that the baseball season is so long, you know, like, and there's so many games, right? So you probably spent more time listening to his voice than, you know, like watching a Tom Cruise movie or something.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, even though he's way more famous, like the level of like intimacy or like the you know, connection you feel to a person's personality and voice, like I mean, he was the best, man. Like and you know, that's the beauty of baseball, I think, is just it's storytelling, you know. It's like it's a slow game, and there's room for that. There's room for people to kind of people like Dave, the masters, you know, that can like tell those stories and build those relationships between the fans and the players.
Yeah. I think there's a huge misconception about this too, because I mean, I'm sure you heard it, but like one of the big narratives around baseball now is how young people are losing interest in it and how it's not as exciting as the NBA or the NFL. And then some of the sort of conversations within that have to do with, you know, the actual broadcast. And if, you know, like I've heard people say like, oh, every broadcast team should have someone under 40, or they should have someone who, you know, is like sort of, I guess, the avatar of youth. And I'm like, that's, you know, it's, that's an idea, but it really is just about quality. It doesn't matter how old you are. Like, you know, right. Dave Niehaus by the end was old. Vin Scully was in his 80s and he was still the best at what he did. So like, yeah. I think it's a misconception for everyone to think, like, not everyone, but for the people of this school of thought to be like, you know, the game is dying because all the announcers are in their 60s. It's like, no, those announcers aren't connecting with people because they're not as good as at their job as other people. Like, it's not complicated. It's not like you have to have, you know, someone who looks and sounds like every kid in America for them to like it. If you have Dave Niehaus, who's a master storyteller, mm-hmm. you're going to connect with kids. Like, I think a lot of times people are looking past the problem in situations like these.
Sure. Yeah. And it's like there's like a shared history, you know, and like, it's really, you know, like going back to like, just like ancient cultures, you know, just like passing down, you know, it's oral histories or something, you know, it really feels like that. It's passing down the game from one generation to the next. And maybe that's kind of what's getting lost, is, you know, we're so focused on like the instant gratification I don't know when it went off the rails, really, but like, it's not about just like the home runs and the you know, championships and stuff. It's just like it's about the local teams that don't always win, but like, you know, yeah. I mean, I think the. For me, when it got like when all the games moved off of just basic TV and onto like cable, and like it, you know, you weren't sure what channel the games were going to be on, even like that really like kind of fragmented my focus on the game. I think like there's, you know, there's like, I think right now with like in all the different media outlets, it's just like it's hard to feel a kinship to like one team, you know, and maybe that's good in some ways because the like games are growing and more people around the world are seeing it, but like, you know, it used to be you just like watch your team, you know, listen to like your radio, like whatever you were able to receive on I just feel like an old guy.
No, I see what you're getting at though, because it is, I think for me, that thing that you're talking about can be a little bit of a double-edged sword, like knowing that, because I like, you know, I've subscribed to MLB TV, so because I want to watch baseball, I love baseball, so I want to have as much of it as possible. And like when I realized that like that was just basically an avenue to not watching the Mariners, it did sort of turn me off. Like I realized in some of those bad Mariner seasons, last year is a perfect example, like I realized that when I came home, like, yeah, I could watch the Mariners, or I could check in on the other teams who sometimes have, you know, this is not to shade the Mariners broadcasters or anything like that, but like some of them have more interesting, or it's just different. Like, you know, it feels fun because it's different. So I remember when I first, you know, this was, I guess, 6 years ago or so, when I first got MLB TV, I was like, oh, I can just listen to Vin Scully every night. Of course I'm going to do that. Or John Miller, who does the Giants broadcast. You know, knowing that that was there and then actually realizing that you could do it every night, like, really opened my eyes to the fact that baseball can be something beyond just your local team. And it still has the same, like, it's put that same feeling in my chest listening to Vin Scully as it did listening to Dave Niehaus, even if Vin Scully was talking about a Dodgers reliever who I had literally never heard of in my entire life. Right. I was like, this to me is the same thing, and I feel at ease even if I don't really know what's going on.
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I love baseball, but, like, I think I'm more of a Mariners fan than I am a baseball fan, though. You know what I mean? Like, I know every minutia of, like, you know, just, like, Mariners trivia, but when it comes to, like, other teams and stuff, you know, it's a pretty, like, basic knowledge of just, like, or I'm always, like, a couple years behind. You know, on, like, the rest of the league, I feel like. But, yeah, I don't know. To each their own, I guess.
So one thing I wanted to ask you about, because I think you have kind of a unique perspective on this as a musician, is I was wondering if you ever see any parallels between baseball and music. Because, like, I've always thought for musicians, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm sure you reach a certain point where listening to music isn't necessarily the same thing as it used to be. Like, I'm sure you're listening to music sometimes and noticing the technical side or analyzing chord progressions or whatever. And that, for me, is, as someone who now is covering the Mariners and thinking about them more than I ever have in my life, is, like, when I'm watching them now, it's not the same purity of fandom as when I was a kid. It starts to feel a little more like a job or an obligation. So I guess, do you still feel the unbridled fandom that you started with, or has it worn down? And then also, do you ever think about baseball like, oh, this is similar to, you know, if someone's struggling at the plate, it's like, oh, this is when I'm, you know, I feel this way when I can't figure out a song or I can't get this sound right. Like, how do you ever feel those two parts of your brain coming together?
Yeah, all the time. I think it's the, you know, going back to Ichiro, just like the consistency of his approach, I feel like you know, I think about that a lot when I'm looking at my music career and, like, you know, not getting, like, instant results or something. Like, if anything, like, it's made me really appreciate the craft of baseball, you know what I mean? Like, just like a well-crafted song, you know, it might not be the flashiest thing, but, like, the people who are in it for the long haul, you know, like, one of my favorite songwriters is Ron Sexsmith. He's a Canadian guy, and not too many people have heard of him, but he puts out just really, like, just great albums year after year, and the songs are just, like, perfectly formed, and it feels like an Ichiro at bat, you know, just like just singles. But maybe that's why I love the Mariners so much, you know, because, like, I mean, I haven't had, like, huge success, but there's been, like, moments of joy and, like, of you know, small moments of triumph on you know, at my level, you know what I mean? But, like, it really feels like each moment feels earned. I feel that way about the Mariners. It's just like it's I don't know how I'm gonna feel, you know, if and when they actually win the World Series. You know, it's just like I hope it's not like the Astros. You know, I hope it's clean, and I hope it's just like they work their asses off and get some luck and you know, just with a really great team of personalities that people can relate to. And, you know, I really believe that that's kind of, that's the Seattle that I believe in, you know, like it's not just like bringing in the biggest names or the throwing money at a problem. Like, I feel like you know, just the small steps, the incremental improvements, are so much more satisfying. And yeah, I mean, that's how I view my music as well, I think. So
yeah, no, I get it. I think I, like, as you were saying it, I was like, this all actually does make a lot of sense, because I think the Mariners are like the MLB equivalent of, you know, I don't want to say struggling artist, but like the artist who has, you know, their passionate fan base who love them, and even if they're not, you know, they're Rolling Stones or whatever. And then the Mariners, I guess, have had their two huge songs in 95 and 2001, but the rest are mostly just for the hardcore fans, you know. And like, it is, the Mariners really are, now that I'm thinking about it more, like, they are not for everyone. Like, it's hard to be a sports fan of a team that sucks, you know. Like, it's very easy to listen, you know, to the Mariners, I guess, to continue the metaphor, to like listen to their album and be like, there was, you know, maybe one thing I liked on there.
Like, right,
that's,
right.
That's been most of their teams. It's like, you know, I like Ichiro, yeah. I like Felix, but I don't need this, you know, I don't need this Ben Broussard song on here or whatever. And now, I guess, like, this is an interesting time for the Mariners, too, because they have so many young guys that we're kind of watching all of them put their careers together in real time. Like,
yeah.
I was, not to brag or anything, but I went on television and talked about how Kyle Lewis feels like, you know, we heard his debut album, and now the next step is, what does the second album sound like? And that can be so hard for athletes and musicians, I imagine, to have sustained success after the first big thing that gets everyone's attention. You know what I mean? Do you ever do that with players where you're like, oh, I bet, you know, they're good, but they need to really improve upon this. Like, if they added, you know, this sound, or, you know, maybe if, like, the team is good, but they need a better drummer. Like, do you ever find yourself thinking about baseball in those terms? I guess the question, like,
yeah,
being
kind of the other way around. Yeah, like, when I look at bands, you know, like, or like when I look at a set list. You know, okay, I definitely think about it in baseball terms. You know, like, you got to have the leadoff hitter, and then the you know, like, the scrappy number two hitter that can, like, advance the runner, and then the track three is always going to be the best, the big hitter, and then the cleanup. You know, and like, it does influence your way of thinking, for sure. You know.
Yeah, that's actually funny. The set list thing, I think, is actually pretty spot on, because you do, like, yeah, the first one is the attention grabber, and they need to set the table, and then, you know, the third one is usually the hit. Like, they actually might be onto something there. And then you have also, like, you know, as you know, like, there's way more to the set list or the lineup than just those nine things. Like, you have, you know, Scott Service, I guess, would be the producer, and Jerry DePoto is the record exec and all that. Like,
sure.
There really is a lot more to baseball than just baseball. Just like, there's a lot more to the music you hear than just the instruments on the song.
Yeah, and there's people at every level, and you know, it's a team sport. You know, it's just like, no matter how good a player is, it still takes you got to have the rest of the, you know, the roster and the coaches. And there's you know, I mean, there's so many places where it could go wrong, you know, which is kind of the story of the Mariners,
right.
But like, but when it does go right, it's just it's such it feels good, you know. It's a journey that you get to go on with all these players. So
yeah, I think when that journey happens, you start to feel connected to them. Like, you feel like you know them the way you know your favorite musician, because you've spent so much time with them. Or they've been, you know, for the Mariners, they've been basically in your living room. And it's like, I get it. I see these guys have worked so hard. I love the product they put out. And now I feel like I get to be a part of it. I think that's kind of the beauty of both baseball and art, is feeling like you, like, something that millions of people are consuming can also feel like it was made especially for you.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's why, you know, that's why I have hope for Taiwan, you know. Like, if he's gonna make a comeback, like, Seattle's the place that he needs to be, like, doing it, you know.
Yeah, no, you're preaching to the choir. I think we're all rooting for Taiwan to have a late career resurgence, you know.
That late though, right? Like, how old is
he? I guess I was just thinking in music terms, you know, like this. You're right. This is not that late for him. He just had, you know, he had a rough patch, I guess, and injuries are such a part of sports too. Like, you can't really prepare for that the same way a musician could prepare the next couple albums, but
We're all waiting for Taiwan. I'm still waiting for the Dustin Ackley comeback, you know. It's coming one of these days.
I think he would have to completely change everything. He'd have to do a full transformation, because sadly, I mean, it didn't seem to work at all. And I think he'd have to start from the ground up with a whole new production team and find, you know, a new sound and all that for it to really work.
I still keep watching like YouTube videos of his rookie season, and he had such a beautiful swing, just like really natural. I don't know what happened, but like, he was such a natural hitter, you know.
Yeah, I'm not smart enough to really know what happened, but it seems like, I mean, the common thread seems to be Jack Cerenzik, unfortunately. Like, that whole era, you really didn't have, besides Kyle Seager, you didn't really have any of the prospects work out, and you have to think that at a certain point, it's the people in charge who are somewhat responsible for that.
Yeah.
But who knows?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't want to get you thinking about that at the very end, but the Jack Cerenzik years are not a great mental spot to be.
Zarenzik, that's another guy I rode an elevator with, but I was not happy at all about that one.
Yeah, that's not as fun as the Dave Niehaus story.
Yeah. All right. Yeah.
Cool. Well, Tomo, thank you so much for doing this. I really enjoyed our conversation. I think that the people at home will agree, and I'm glad that we got to get this in before the season starts, because I think when you have this much downtime, all like your thoughts about the Mariners are much different than when you're thinking about the actual wins and losses, you know what I mean? Because that can really start to cloud your vision. Yeah. If we were to do this like in after a 6-game losing streak, I'm sure it'd be a little bit of a different vibe. So
yeah, awesome.
Thanks for making time. And before I let you go, I want to the floor is yours to plug whatever you want to plug. Direct people to your social media or your work or any of your upcoming concerts. This is your time to brag about yourself.
So I have a new album called Melon Day. It's kind of a synth pop dance album, which I've never done before, but it's coming out on April 7th, and then the album release show is going to be on April 30th at the Sunset with Night Tapes and another band, and it's going to be a fun year, I think, I hope it'll be a fun year of baseball as well.
Let's hope. I mean, I have higher hopes for your albums than I do for the 2020 Mariners. But it's cool that it comes out, early in the season. Like, you know, it's kind of, you're starting, you know, it's like an opening day almost. Like, you're starting right around the same time, unleashing it on the world, and then you get spring and summer to sit with it. Like, that seems pretty cool. I'm sure that wasn't your thought, but, you know, me with my baseball mind was like, oh, that's cool.
Absolutely, yeah, and I'm looking forward to seeing the young guys come up, you know, like Kelenic and Sheffield, and it's just going to be an exciting season, really. Like, it's a fresh start, you know.
Yeah, I feel like there's some poetry to this being the first season of a new decade. Like, the 2020s, I feel like, are really going to be the rebirth of the Mariners. I mean, I hope, at least, because Yep. When we got close to the playoffs in 2016 and 2018, like, you could still feel the window closing because we had an aging roster and we had guys on short contracts. But now I'm personally thrilled to see, even if it doesn't work, just to see what happens when we have a team of our guys. And I think this is the first year of that. So I know people are going to disagree with that. People do not want to hear about patience when it comes to the Mariners, but that's all we can really do at this point.
That's all we got.
It is all we got. Well, you can follow me on Twitter at mroberson22. Subscribe to this podcast. Read Lookout Landing. Support the Seattle Mariners in sickness and health and all that good stuff. And until next week or whenever I talk to you again, thank you so much for listening. Thank you, Tomo. And goodbye. No one's